You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, researchers are learning more about the novel coronavirus every day. We'll talk to a virologist about the latest research and how it could help develop treatments for COVID-19. First, November 3rd is the date of our presidential election this year, but the yet-to-be-determined results of the elections are already facing many challenges that could potentially push back an official outcome. Among the big questions surrounding this election, how do people vote fairly and safely during a pandemic? Election law expert Justin Levitt has been tracking the lawsuits already filed around the country. He's cited in a recent Bloomberg article titled, "Everybody is Suing, Trump-Biden Election Sets Up Legal Logjam." Justin's a professor of law at Loyola Marymount University Law School in Los Angeles. He previously served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Well, at your latest count, how many lawsuits are out there related to this 2020 election?
These are just the lawsuits that have to do with the pandemic. So you have to add a lot of continuing litigation from the last couple of years that's still got to sort itself out. But I'm up to 166 cases in 41 states and D.C. so far. And that's, by any measure, an awful lot of lawyers in an awful lot of courtrooms. And I know Wisconsin has seen more than its fair share.
Yeah, one of those issues, one of the themes in the lawsuits that you looked at, particularly relevant here in Wisconsin, when it comes to consolidation of polling places. We saw a fair amount of that during our primary election that we held. Can you talk about the types of suits out there that address this idea of we can't have all of our polling sites open?
Yeah, it's not actually clear to me how much litigation is going to be able to do about that. So, unfortunately, the pandemic is changing the way that we vote. Traditionally, everybody's used to voting entailing large numbers of people gathering in a small number of small places. And that can't happen this year. Wisconsin obviously saw that front and center during its primaries earlier this year. But the main barrier to opening the number of polling places to actually serve Wisconsin's public wasn't policy as much as it was simple lack of resources and a sudden lack of resources from the sudden onset of COVID-19. So if locations don't feel that it's safe to allow voting in a particular place, and people who had volunteered to be poll workers don't feel like they're safe in showing up, that creates a huge problem. We rely tremendously in this country on volunteer resources to help run elections. And unfortunately, Wisconsin ran into the sharp end of that buzzsaw right in its primaries in April. And not just in Milwaukee, I should point out. A lot of attention, very rightly so, turned to the radical reduction in the number of polling places open in Milwaukee, due in part to a large number of poll workers canceling. But a week before the election this April, there were over 100 rural towns in Wisconsin that didn't have one poll worker available, not even one. And so the impact of relying on volunteer help to keep the polls open really shows some of the weaknesses in the system.
So you say that may not have a lot of recourse. The option for voting in person for many people will be voting by mail. Now, Attorney General William Barr was before Congress today talking about a lot of different stuff. Voting by mail came up, its impact on the fairness of the election. Barr said he thinks a wholesale transition to voting by mail would create a large risk of election fraud, though there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence of a big risk. What are we seeing, though, when it comes to lawsuits surrounding voting by mail?
You're seeing a lot of litigation around voting by mail, in part because the system that we have isn't particularly used to acting quickly. And as you indicated, you got to act really quickly in a pandemic. So some states have had lots of voting by mail for a long time. I happen to be sitting in one, California, about 60% of voters voted by mail. It's up to 90, 95, 99% in states like Oregon and Washington. Other states are much less accustomed to voting by mail and have had only 2, 3, 4% vote by mail. In a pandemic where there simply aren't as many resources to be able to vote in person, and we'll always need some, I have to emphasize that. For some populations, it's really important to be able to get to the polls. But in a pandemic, in order to save those resources, we really need as many people as possible to vote by mail. It is secure. It has been secure. But not all of the rules and regulations currently on the books are flexible enough to allow the ramp up we need. So a lot of people are understandably turning to the courts saying, hey, we've got some regulations. They might suit a normal period, but not a pandemic. We need your help, courts, in opening things up.
Have there been challenges in the other direction? People saying, hey, wait a minute, you are making it too easy to vote by mail. You're defeating the purpose of what we intended as just a backup absentee balloting system.
There have been some. I'll say they haven't really been successful. The more successful version of that is lawsuits against particular decision makers claiming that this should be an issue for a legislature or should be an issue that the courts have to implement rather than executives that have issued orders. We saw some of that push and pull in Wisconsin as well, with push and pull against the governor attempting to postpone or delay the primary date. The allegations pushing back against the wholesale opening up of vote by mail, saying this is an avenue to fraud or this is an avenue to misconduct, really haven't gone so well. And there's a good reason for that. The fears of widespread fraud in the system aren't really backed up by evidence at all. There are, of course, a few circumstances in a few local elections when something has happened with the mail system, just like there are occasional reports in local elections of stuffing the ballot boxes in an old-fashioned way. But there's no evidence of any widespread problem that would affect a statewide election or a national election. And though that argument has gotten a little bit of traction in sort of public discourse, the courts demand evidence, and there really isn't much evidence to offer. And so people who have challenged the opening up of the rules, saying this is going to lead to fraud, when the court says, okay, show me, there's not a lot to show.
Talking to Justin Levitt, law professor at Loyola Marymount University Law School in Los Angeles, looking at lawsuits already related to the 2020 election and to voting changes in the midst of a pandemic. There are some other categories, Justin, but I want to get into the potential impact here. We could, either in a local election or congressional or even presidential, we could end up on election day with a lot of potentially unresolved lawsuits. Is that right?
I think most of the lawsuits will be resolved by then. The good news, if there is good news in this much litigation this early, is that we're getting some of the fights out of the way. I'd much rather have a lawsuit in March or April or May that gives an answer in July or August than have the same lawsuit in October that last passed the election. But I do think on election night, you're going to have a number of states where even if the litigation's resolved, the actual election count may not be. That is, in states that are really close, and Wisconsin certainly looks like it may be one of those, the number of absentee ballots is going to make it hard to get a result on election night. And I think the really important thing for people to remember is that's okay. That is, if it takes longer than election night to actually count all the ballots, that's a sign that the system is working and not that it's broken. We have a really good system, actually, for checking the list once and then checking it twice to make sure that the number of ballots we've got and the ballots add up as they're supposed to. And I think we're all going to have to indulge a little bit of patience in allowing that time to play out rather than seeing the election countdown on election night and seeing that the ticker go off and seeing that the polls have closed and then thinking that there's something wrong when they don't actually call a state for Biden or for Trump. Really, that's just the process working as it should. We'll get a count. It just may take a little while longer this time.
You mentioned lawsuits in March or April or maybe later in the game in October. How about a November 4th? If I've lost an election, say, and I think something has been done wrong in the election system or want to claim that it's been done wrong, could we see a bunch of lawsuits the day of, day after Election Day?
Yeah, we might well see that as well. One thing we've learned is that people, either incumbents who are seeking to keep office or those who are seeking to take it, will sort of turn to a whole bunch of different mechanisms to try and establish who actually won. It is not unthinkable that we might have a lawsuit filed on November 4th or November 3rd that takes a little while to resolve. That's also part of the dispute resolution process we've got. So where there's uncertainty in the count, those lawsuits, that litigation, is part of the process for figuring out, okay, are we sure we've got the count right? And that too, that can feel really uncomfortable because it feels really contentious, but that's actually the system working. And courts are pretty good about navigating the straits of a lawsuit to overturn an election or to try and make sure we got the results right for an election. They demand evidence, and that's a way of holding us all accountable.
We'll leave it there. Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course.
Justin Levitt is professor of law at Loyola Marymount University Law School in Los Angeles. We talked to him today about a large amount already of lawsuits filed around the country relating to the 2020 election and voting during a pandemic. Coming up, we could have a vaccine potentially as early as the start of the new year for the novel coronavirus, according to at least some hopeful predictions. We'll talk to a virologist about some of the latest research into COVID-19 and the virus that causes it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump signed 4 executive orders last week that could impact the price of prescription drugs. We'll find out more about the orders and what these mandates could do. Now, since early spring, the U.S. has seen a significant increase in the number of COVID-19 cases. Over that time span, the U.S. has had more than 4 million confirmed cases of the illness, and we've crossed the 150,000 death mark, according to some tallies. Over the past few months, researchers have learned more about the virus that causes the illness, and as we learn more, we get closer to, hopefully, development of vaccines and treatments to combat the spread of the disease and help people recover. Thomas Friedrich is a professor of virology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. His lab works to understand how pandemic viruses emerge, spread, and cause disease. He has worked on HIV/AIDS, influenza, Zika, and is now working on COVID-19. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there. Good to be with you.
Well, you last joined us, I think, a couple months-ish ago. What do you see as some of the key things we've learned since then about this virus?
Well, there are a lot of things that we've learned, and there's a lot of things that we would like to know. We've evaluated some treatments, as you alluded to at the very beginning there. We found evidence that hydroxychloroquine, which was touted initially as a potential treatment, probably does not work, and in fact may be dangerous for some people to use. We've learned that, from animal studies, that a vaccine is likely quite possible, although we're still not ready to vaccinate humans yet. But there's a lot of optimism that vaccines will become available in the not too distant future. But they are not available yet. And so that means that all of the practices that we've heard about and maybe begun to get a little sick of, remain our best defense. So, masking, social distancing, and so forth.
I want to get into some headlines that people may have seen and get your thoughts on them when it comes to the novel coronavirus. One that was making the rounds for a while, that there are 2 main strains, or at least that's what people thought at one point, of the novel coronavirus. So I think just one mutation apart from each other. Concern that the later coming one maybe spread easier than the original one. It wasn't necessarily more harmful, but it spread faster. What is the latest thought on the different strains and whether the difference makes a difference?
Yeah, that's a good question, and the exact kind of thing that I study in my research. So happy to talk about that. There is this mutation that causes a little change in the protein that the virus uses to get into cells, and so it seems at least plausible that that change could affect the way the virus could transmit from one person to another. And there's some evidence that viruses that have this particular mutation, which we call D614G, are becoming more abundant in the world as time goes on. But there's really not conclusive evidence yet that this mutation is biologically important. So, for example, in our own studies, we've been following the kind of genetic changes in the virus in the Madison area and in the Milwaukee area. And we find that there were viruses that had sort of the old version, the D version in Madison, and they have seemed to have largely died out in Madison in the last couple of months, which would be consistent with the idea that maybe the G version spreads easier. But we didn't find that in Milwaukee. So, Milwaukee had the most, the largest outbreak in Wisconsin by far back in March and April. And a substantial proportion of viruses there had the old version, the D that is supposedly less transmissible. So that virus was going around in Milwaukee just fine back in March and April. We've just sequenced a batch of new viruses from Milwaukee, and so we'll be able to tell more about what's going on there in the near future, but we haven't analyzed that data yet. So all in all, I'm not sure that there's a really big important difference that this mutation confers.
And speaking of mutation, I know viruses mutate. It's part of what they do. Do we have a sense, just what, 8 months into this thing now, of how fast this particular virus is mutating compared to others we might be familiar with?
Yeah. So one thing about coronaviruses in general is that they evolve much more slowly than viruses that we might be familiar with, like influenza and HIV, ones that I also study. And so I think overall, that's good news. And so we would expect that this novel coronavirus would not, evolve quite as rapidly as influenza. And so far, that seems to be the case. So people have estimated the kind of pace of its mutation and its evolution. And it does seem to be slower than what we would see for HIV or influenza, other kind of fast evolving viruses. On the other hand, the virus is infecting a lot of people, and the more people it infects, the more mutations get made. And so that can kind of make up for a slower overall mutation rate. So as time goes on, I think we still need to watch very closely because, for example, when vaccines become available, people become vaccinated, there will be more like evolutionary pressure on the virus to change. And so we may expect to see more changes as more people become immune through infection or vaccination. But we're just sort of not in a stage where that's going to happen yet.
Talking to Thomas Friedrich, professor of virology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. As we've heard, he is researching the virus that causes COVID-19. You mentioned immunity. And again, in the headlines, there are, I think it's fair to say, just anecdotal reports from some doctors about their patients or some patients saying they were reinfected. They had it, they were positive, they were negative, and then positive again. Again, I want to emphasize anecdotal. This is not locked down. Can you talk about what we know about immunity, how long it might last after having the disease, and whether someone can catch it again?
Yeah, also good questions and sort of a lot to unpack there. So I'll do the best I can to be concise. So there's a couple of questions. One is, after you get infected and you become immune, how long will that immunity last? There's some concern because when people have studied other coronaviruses, and there are four seasonal coronaviruses that cause the common cold in people, it seems that at least for some of those viruses, your immunity can decrease a lot faster than we might expect than for other viruses. And so you may get them again, a year, a couple of years later, not because those viruses have mutated substantially and evaded your immune defenses, but just because your immunity has worn off, basically. And so there's a lot of concern that this may happen for COVID-19. And we just don't know enough yet to be able to say how long the average person's immunity will last after they are infected and recovered. But so far, it looks like most people make pretty good immune responses to the virus. And so we'd be surprised if people got infected very soon after having a first infection with the novel coronavirus. There have been reports of people testing positive and then negative and then positive again. And that probably does not mean that most of those people got reinfected, but rather it seems like when most people get infected, it takes a while for the body to fully clear the virus, even after symptoms resolve and get better. And so on very sensitive tests that are the kind of tests that you might get like today at the Alliant Energy Center, you may test positive and have a very low amount of virus still in your body. And then so you may spend a long time with a little bit of virus. And so if you got tested multiple times in that phase, that sort of long tail of the infection, you may be positive. And then the amount of virus may go below the threshold of detection. So like the limit of detection for that test, and then may go up again and may go down again. So you may sort of oscillate around just barely being positive. And I suspect that most of these cases, that's what we're seeing. in very unusual circumstances, maybe someone who's immune compromised and can't make a good immune response, you might expect that they could get the virus a couple of times in a short period of time, but that would be probably rare.
I know one hope at various points throughout all of this is the idea that, okay, if enough of us get this, we'll start to develop what's called herd immunity. Enough of us will have a resistance to this disease that will start to slow the spread of it. Are we anywhere near something like that?
Short answer is no. So herd immunity is thought to kick in when a significant proportion of people are immune, either through having been infected before or having gotten vaccinated. And for other viruses, you know, that's been estimated to be like 60% of people, 70% up to 90% of the population or even more has to be immune for that herd immunity to protect people who have not been infected themselves. And even in places that have been really hard hit, like in New York City, they estimate that maybe about 20% of people already have antibodies against the coronavirus. But that means that 80% don't. And so they are still susceptible to further outbreaks. That's very far from herd immunity. And it would take a long time of just letting infection go unchecked for us to get to the point where, you know, 70% of the population of the United States, to pick a number between 60 and 90, you know, would be immune. So we're nowhere close to that, unfortunately.
We'll leave it there for now. Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
All right. Thanks very much, Rob.
Thomas Friedrich is a professor of virology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. His lab works to understand how pandemic viruses emerge, spread, and cause disease. He has studied HIV/AIDS, influenza, Zika, and is now working on COVID-19. And he joined us today to talk about what we've learned recently about the novel coronavirus. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the politics behind a series of recent executive orders signed by President Trump that are intended to lower prescription drug prices. We'll look at some of the orders, the effect they might have, and possible challenges that could be down the road. And you can join in with your thoughts and questions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, Kate Archer Kent talks to a personal finance expert about how to make the most of retirement plans in a tough economic time. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump signed a series of executive orders on Friday that aim to bring down prescription drug prices in the United States. The orders aim to have healthcare providers pass on discounts to patients, eliminate so-called middle manager dealings, allow prescription drugs to be imported from other countries, and potentially use Medicare as leverage for negotiations. While the president is revisiting a 2016 campaign promise with these orders, critics say they're not enforceable and are largely symbolic. Our next guest joins us to talk about how prescription drug prices are regulated and the politics behind these executive orders. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's the author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, good to be with you, Rob.
Well, these four executive orders, first of all, big picture, how big a deal were they?
Well, I mean, in one sense, you can see this as some of these things were already sort of going into the works already. There are two orders that the FDA and the Trump administration were sort of already working on. So the executive order sort of brings those to light, makes them public, and allows the president to claim some political leverage or ownership over. But they're not huge deals. The issues that really are big deals here, the plan that would allow for what's called reference pricing of drugs, that would allow the government to negotiate with drug companies based on international reference prices, which would really potentially be a lot of savings. That is something that the structure of it and indeed like the reaction from the pharmaceutical industry suggests that that this is certainly a big plan, but and would have substantial consequences if implemented. But given the structure of it and given the response from the industry, it seems pretty unlikely that that is actually going to go into effect. So the places where we're seeing like the biggest movement are also the places where this seems like the most sort of election year politicking rather than sort of substantive policy making.
Let's talk about that reference pricing idea. We hear the complaint often that here in the U.S. we pay X amount more for drug Y than they do in, say, European countries or in Canada. How would this referencing idea work if it actually came into effect?
Yeah, so this is something, and I'll just the sort of by way of background, this is something that when you look at public opinion surveys, you know, you get a super majority of Americans, Democrats and Republicans alike, suggesting that the federal government should have the power to, through Medicare, negotiate the price of drugs. And what this proposal would do if enacted is it would allow Medicare to negotiate for the price of a drug on a particular list of Medicare approved drugs that matches the lowest price paid among foreign governments. Now, this is something that there have been some studies of what it would be like if Medicare Part D had access to negotiated federal pricing for about 200 drug formulations that seniors typically take. And you know, the annual federal savings would be something like $21.9 billion. So, you know, a lot of money, and obviously consumers would see some of that savings. Now, the issue, there are sort of two issues. One issue is that in the structure of the executive order, the administration doesn't even begin putting this rule into effect or starting the process until late August. And that is supposed to create breathing room for the pharmaceutical industry to propose something else. And so the question you have to ask is, if that sort of breathing room is there and it's widely assumed, and the pharma lobbying group has sort of specifically said that there will be pushback, probably there will be, you know, if this were to go into effect, a lawsuit. But if that is the structure and if that's the industry's response, you know, can we really expect this rule to go into effect? Is it really a sort of does it represent a substantive sort of change in position for the administration? And I think there are some doubts there, and they're fairly reasonable ones. The other sort of critique that some analysts of this rule have made is that when you base the U.S. prices on these international reference prices, that it's not exactly clear how those other countries with those lowest prices paid are going to react. And in fact, it could be the case that in response, those countries raise their prices to some extent in response to the rule. Now, it's very, very hard to say with any certainty exactly what would happen. And that's sort of, you know, I'll sort of leave that to the health economists. But I think overall what this suggests is that, yes, I mean, this is a very popular sort of idea. I think if implemented, the savings would be tremendous. The question is, you know, how deep does this preference go within the administration? I mean, it's typical that presidential administrations in an election year will propose things that they don't necessarily have a credible commitment to. And so, you know, from what we've been seeing thus far, there's some doubts about that with the so-called favored nations rule, which is this part of the executive order.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University, looking at the president's executive orders on prescription drug costs. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about these orders and how they work, or your thoughts, what you would like to see when it comes to federal policy on prescription drug costs. 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to the president on that, the Medicare negotiation issue, criticizing Congress here.
Under our ridiculous system, which has been broken for decades, we aren't even allowed to negotiate the price of drugs. Can you believe it? I said, when are we going to negotiate? We're not allowed. We're restricted by Congress from negotiating the price of drugs. Can you imagine? You say, I want to get a better price. I'm sorry, sir. You're not allowed to do that. That's illegal. What kind of a system is that?
He's talking about Medicare there. Why is this something that Medicare isn't allowed to negotiate on?
Well, I mean, you have to consider the politics of health reform in Congress, okay? And the way that I like to put it is this. When there is a new potential benefit on the table, say the new Medicare Part D benefit or the Affordable Care Act, you know, expansion of Medicaid, those are the kind of policies that drive public support in a big way because there's really something on the table that's interpretable or legible for most people. But when Congress puts policies on the table that they're not necessarily as legible or salient, they might have a broad benefit for the public, but they're not as legible for the public. The main people that come out, or the main organized industries that come out to deliberate over the bill or to lobby over the bill, are the pharmaceutical industry. And so, you know, we've seen this over the last 20 years. Really, I think you saw the first sort of instance of this in the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, which created Medicare Part D. And then again, with the Affordable Care Act, is that the sort of the price of admission or the toll for going on the toll road of legislation is on health reform, or has been historically, that if you want to get a big reform passed, pharma's price of admission is you can't do anything to really limit our profits for pharmaceuticals. And I think the history of the lobbying over the Affordable Care Act is one very clear place where, in order to get pharma, if not on board, then at least a little bit less aggressive in its opposition to the ACA, the designers of the law had to sort of abandon their interest in giving Medicare the power to negotiate prices. That is something that, were it possible and were pharma not the roadblock there, you can imagine that the people who wrote the ACA probably would have been pretty interested in doing that. But this is something where the sort of pluralistic interest group lobbying politics that surround these issues really give a kind of veto power to these pretty well-mobilized interests like pharma.
We're talking to Phil Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, looking at President Trump's recent executive orders that aim to bring down the price of prescription drugs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these recent executive orders? What do you think they'll accomplish? Is this an issue for you? If you're someone who has to pay a lot for prescriptions out of pocket, what would you like to see change if you work in healthcare yourself? What do you see from where you're sitting? And do you have questions about how all this works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about recent executive orders signed by President Trump that are, in theory, supposed to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. Philip Rocco is with us, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, author of the book Obamacare Wars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the move from President Trump? How do you think the pharmaceutical industry should be regulated? Is there something you'd like to see done to bring down the cost of prescription drugs in the United States? Do you have questions about the politics behind this and how this all works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Anura Rose on Facebook, who writes, what would be more impressive would be if he signed an executive order that a company could only make a 20% profit off of the medications. Phil, this idea of limiting profits for prescription drug companies, is this something that's been out there in the political sphere?
Yeah, I mean, so just to give you a sense of the public opinion on this, there are about 72% of Americans surveyed. I think this is a Kaiser Family Foundation poll last year. About 72% think that the pharmaceutical industry has too much power. About 80% think that they make too much in profit from the medications and prescriptions that they sell. And it's not necessarily that hard to understand why people have those sort of attitudes, right? About 6 in 10 Americans take a prescription drug. 1 in 4 take 4 or more prescription drugs. And about 79% of Americans say that they find prescriptions to be unaffordable. And it's interesting to see what's happened during the COVID-19 pandemic, because we've actually seen a pretty substantial spike in prescription drug prices. There's been a measurable several hundred percent increase in those prices, and not surprisingly, there's been a huge increase in a fear among the public that they won't be able to afford the prescriptions that they take anymore. And so, from the sort of in the public sphere and sort of in the public's mind, there's something unsavory and in a way unfair about the amount of profit that is made off of prescription drugs. I mean, if you look at the quarterly reports of pharmaceutical companies during the pandemic, as other industries have faltered and failed, these companies are doing quite well. Now, when it comes to enacting an executive order to limit profits to something like 20%, that would obviously take probably an act of Congress to do something like that, or to put another way, to make this sector into a more sort of public entity, I think would take a sort of a legislative revolution, really sort of on the order of the New Deal's sort of legislative revolution. But it's not impossible by any means. It's something that it's hard to imagine coming out of an executive order, and certainly probably not an executive order from the Trump administration. What we have is a set of proposals that I think try to work to some extent within the existing legislative framework, even maybe pushing the envelope a little bit compared to what we might have thought the administration would have done back in 2017. But certainly, I think, are trying to respond to this sort of massive feeling that's very consistent with what the caller or the listener said, which is that there's something sort of unsavory about the amount of profits that these companies make from prescription drugs.
Let's bring on a caller now. Gordon is with us in Fitchburg. Gordon, hi.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. Thank you for taking the call. I wanted to check a couple of things, if the speaker could remind us if my recollection is accurate. Wasn't Medicare Part D separate from the Affordable Care Act? My recollection is Medicare Part D was put in during the Bush administration, and I wonder if we could be reminded who was the Secretary of Health and Human Services during that time. Medicare Part D was one of the largest, maybe the largest, public service benefit since Medicare itself.
And I'm going to jump in, Gordon, because we just have a minute or so left. Medicare Part D predated the Affordable Care Act, I think, right?
That's right. Phil? Yeah, absolutely. And I think I mentioned in my comments that there's the 2003 Medicare Modernization Act, which was passed with broad bipartisan support and signed by a Republican president. So, it's not out of the realm of possibility for there to be bipartisan agreement on these issues. But again, the cost of doing business back then in 2003 with Medicare Part D was leaving the government's ability to control or to negotiate the prices sort of off the table or very, very limited.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just very briefly, Phil, what are you watching for next on this?
Well, I think what I'm going to be watching for is what the tete-a-tete between the administration and the industry is. Obviously, the industry right now has sort of balked at even meeting with the White House. But the question is now that the administration really, on the favored nations rule in particular, the other sort of pieces of regulation here are a little bit more modest, but on that one in particular, the question is they've sort of left a wide open space for the industry to promote something else. It's a question of whether or not that something else will be something that Trump wants to run on in an election year. The favored nations rule arguably would be a more popular thing and probably out of joint with what the industry would recommend. So that's what I'll be watching for.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Great to be here, Rob.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's the author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. By the way, Gordon referenced the Department of HHS secretary at the time of Medicare Part D. I believe that would be Wisconsin's own Tommy Thompson. We talked today about President Trump's recent series of executive orders that aim to lower the cost of prescription drugs and the politics behind that move. Farmers have often been seen as a core Republican constituency in recent years, but Wisconsin Democrats are making a play for the agricultural community ahead of this year's presidential election. Hope Kerwin has more on the pitch from both parties and whether farmers are ready to listen.
Vice President Mike Pence has made a handful of visits to Wisconsin this year. His last one was to a dairy farm just north of La Crosse. Pence sat down with local farmers and a state legislator to make his case for how the Trump administration has helped farmers. He pointed to the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which officially replaced NAFTA earlier this month.
USMCA is a win for American workers. It's a win for American farmers. It's a win for American dairy. And it's just one more example of how President Donald Trump puts America first and always will.
Rural communities, especially in western Wisconsin, helped Trump win the state and ultimately the presidency in 2016. And heading into this year's election, the Trump campaign is hoping to secure their votes again. The pitch works for some dairy farmers, like Amy Penterman, who owns Dutch Dairy in Thorpe and sits on the board of the Dairy Business Association. She won't say who she's voting for, but she likes Trump's approach.
You know, I really appreciate the fact that he's working to get trade deals done in other countries that are fair and really focusing on those deals to get them done.
But Trump's trade policy has turned off other dairy farmers who question whether the president has hurt agricultural exports more than he's helped, especially after retaliatory tariffs traded with countries like China and Mexico largely targeted U.S. farm goods. Mitch Breinig owns Mystic Valley Dairy near Sauk City.
When we kind of do these hardline negative negotiations, you know, I think it's just hard to go back and say, yeah, we're going to do business with you because we like to do business with you. You know, those relationships are built over time.
Breinig voted for Trump in 2016, but says he's undecided this year. He feels like the Trump administration isn't aware of the economic situation that farmers are facing. He points to a comment made by Trump during a campaign rally last October, saying farmers would have to buy bigger tractors to meet the new demand from an initial trade deal with China.
They don't really understand my business. They don't understand it at all.
This frustration is what Democrats are hoping to capitalize on as they make a play for the ag community. Earlier this year, Governor Tony Evers called a special legislative session focused on helping struggling dairy farmers. And during a virtual campaign event this summer, presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden said the high number of farm bankruptcies in Wisconsin could be linked to the Trump administration's trade strategy.
How many farmers would be in a better spot if their profits hadn't vanished because Trump goaded our trade partners into placing brutal tariffs on American cheese?
The question, in a year when COVID-19 has captured the public's attention, is whether Wisconsin dairy farmers will hear that message. Anthony Trigoski is a political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He says that given the limited time left before the election, the easiest path for Democrats to win Wisconsin is not through rural communities, but continuing to win over suburban areas.
How much do they focus their pitch on these affluent, educated suburbs where they've seen real growth potential versus how much do they focus on rural communities and agriculture communities where Trump and the Republicans have really solidified their standing?
But Trigoski says it could be a mistake for Democrats to ignore rural Wisconsin. He says that would only deepen the divide between urban and rural communities that was so apparent after the 2016 election. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's a big partisan divide in the country, but the authors of a new book say there are ways we can bridge the gap. A Democrat and a Republican join us to share their search for common ground. The COVID-19 death rate in the U.S. is going up again, but many people are trying to get back to normal. We'll look at the divide between public health experts and some members of the public on the scope of the disease and how to react to it. And we'll meet a Wisconsin artist who's embroidering masks with the words of healthcare workers on the front line of the efforts to stop COVID-19. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8:30, get advice to help you or a loved one stop smoking and find out about the resources available here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow at 8:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the amount of fake news and bad information on social media can seem overwhelming. We'll talk to a former CIA analyst about how to spot fake news and what to do about it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.